5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, flow.
Welcome to AnnaZone 23, where we look at old anime, especially movies and OVAs. These are the films and projects that help shape the anime landscape as we know it today. We want to look at them in their own era and how they were the inspiration for many of the shows and franchises that are popular today. Some have become legends, while others have been deservedly forgotten. All of them, you should remind yourself, someone had to draw that. Thanks, Major Tom. Hello and welcome to another episode of AnnaZone 23. My name is Rick.
Hi, Drew.
And on today's episode of AnnaZone 23, we are going to be talking about the world of elves and dwarves and dragons of high fantasy, specifically anime high fantasy. And we're going to be going back to the early 90s with a couple of shows, one of which was based off light novel, and the other one was based off of a series of fantasy novels, both of which are based heavily in the swords and sorcery worlds of Dungeons and Dragons, a little bit more. And if you're not familiar, Drew, do you want to kind of give a little bit more background into like the fantasy RPG hit, you know, in the history and particularly how it kind of came to Japan?
Well, modern fantasy RPGs can trace a through line pretty much straight back to Tolkien's Lord of the Rings in 56, with another through line going back through there through Fritz Lieber's Lacomar novels, that's Fabled in the Grey Mauser, and a few others back through to Conan, the Conan stories of the 30s. But high fantasy, as we say, as they call it, is pretty much a creation of Tolkien, where you got your elves and your dwarves and everything else. Now, Dungeons and Dragons, which is generally considered the originator, grew out of a set of miniatures rules sometime in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was a sort of fits and starts sort of thing. And as it gained in popularity, there were many other spin-offs. And as with the Lord of the Rings, these are things that got to Japan relatively quickly. Japan is socially said to be 20 years behind the West. Pop culture wise, they're more like maybe 5 at most, and possibly less in this case, because Lord of the Rings and some other high fantasy and new wave sci-fi stuff got into Japan very easily. So not too long after Dungeons and Dragons made it into America, sometime I think in the late 70s, early 80s, role-playing games made it to Japan. Now their path, once they got there, was a little bit different from the U.S., and their relation to media was quite a bit different from how they were set up in the U.S. But they're distinguished, they're obviously fruit of the same tree. They all trace most of their stuff back to Tolkien, and Japanese fantasy even more so, because Japanese fantasy doesn't have that low fantasy history to draw upon.
Yeah, they don't have, because when you look at Tolkien, Tolkien is really just a continuation of English mythology. It's the continuation of, you know, the Arthurian legend, and in some other cases, you know, even from other European
lots
legends, like
Norse mythology.
Yeah, Norse.
A little bit of Slavic and Finnish mythology mixed in there.
Yeah, exactly.
But lots and lots and lots of Norse mythology.
Yeah. In fact, really, if you look at it, you can see a lot of the Norse mythology is sort of wrapped into the dwarves. You know, some of the Finnish
stuff. And the dwarves. The Vizier and the Vanir.
Yeah.
The elves and the dwarves are very much straight out of Norse mythology. It's just that Tolkien was such a world-building behemoth that he added so much to it. But the important thing is this new wave of high fantasy and new wave fantasy and science fiction got to Japan not very long after it got to the West. This was riding the tide, and they adopted many of the same books in about the same period, during the late 60s, when there is a lot of student radicalism and a lot of youth rebellion, which is also when Tolkien really took off, came out in 57. It's generally considered it didn't really take off until about the mid-60s. Very similar. Tolkien didn't take off until about the same time as Stranger in a Strange Land came out, actually, believe it or not. You could almost draw a line through those two. But the important thing is Japan's path to fantasy role-playing is discernibly the same as the West, but the games are slightly different, and the balance is a little bit different. Japan it's definitely...
very much different as an avid gamer. Because when you look at it, early on, even earliest on, some of the earliest RPGs that were turn-based, the only Western or sort of Western and JRPG and Western RPG where they were kind of close would have been around the time of Ultima 1. And it would have been probably the early... Well, Ultima 1 was what, 1980?
One was about 1980. Wizardry was a similar era. Wizardry, we know, was quite successful in ports in Japan because that's how Animego got started.
Yeah.
Or rather, that's how Woodhead made the money that eventually founded Animego, because he's the guy who programmed Wizardry. But we noticed Wizardry got there, and we think Ultima may have got there. We don't see a lot of things for Temple of Apshai, which was big back in the 80s. We don't see anything for Telengard, which was sort of the cheap one you could find everywhere in the 80s, computer-wise. Now, pen and paper-wise, when you go down the lists of things in Japanese fantasy, you'll sometimes notice a long list of obscure weapon names that don't make any sense. Well, they don't make any sense because D&D, despite its famous 20 different pole arms, didn't detail a lot of certain types of weapons that much. Certain other systems did. Tunnels and Trolls, most famously. Flying Buffalo never made an incredible fortune over in Japan, but between that and the Lost World books, which became Queen's Blade, they had a certain amount of market penetration. And you can always, and if you find odd pieces of things that don't look like D&D, it's probably because it was originally Tunnels and Trolls. But you have to do a little bit of digging, and it helps to know the Tunnels and Trolls quirks.
Yeah,
so
when we start seeing, at least in terms of the stuff that people might know, it's once the Famicom and the Sega, it'd be the Sega Master System comes out. Because that's when Nintendo you get Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. On the Sega, you get the Phantasy Star series. I think there was a few others that came a little bit later on some other consoles. Like I think the TurboGrafx / PC Engine had one, but I'm not as familiar with that particular console.
Japan
so I
got
sure.
in very early on the party-based adventure turn-based game computer version, more graphics-based. Most of the originals were more text-based. Wizardry was mostly text. Was mostly text with some graphics. But what Japan missed on was the very first wave. The original mainframe adventure, Atari adventure, and the Odyssey 2, believe it or not, had a Lord of the Rings tie-in game to go with the Bakshi movie.
Yeah,
and Intellivision had Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, but I remember that. I've actually seen that cart before.
Oh, I played it. It's not anything great. But all of those were in the very first wave of computer things. And Japan didn't really get into home video games until... Basically, they got in at just the right time for home computer systems to be just advanced enough to handle a rudimentary turn-based role-playing system. And that would be Dragon Quest. I think Dragon Quest is sort of the grandmother of all of the games.
Yeah. Well, I think I can kind of, just by doing a little bit of research, it looks like, just kind of looking at it, I don't know if it would be really, yeah, actually it says here in the Wikipedia article, it said that the creator of Dragon Quest, Yuji Horii, Took inspiration from Wizardry and Ultima, which if you think about it, you know, they used to be able to program a game within a year. So Dragon Quest came out in 1986. Ultima 4 came out in 1985, which if you look at Ultima 4, it's a turn-based top-down party RPG. You know, you have That's party true. Members.
4 was party. 3 was not party. Yes, 3 was individual not party. Player.
Well, because 4 was the first one to introduce the whole Avatar thing. You know, that basically carried the series all the way up through Ultima 9, when EA just killed the thing. But anyways, yeah, so you have Dragon Warrior, or Dragon Quest, sorry. Dragon Warrior. My uncle had the Dragon Warrior
card. As a console-based, not really knockoff, but an attempt to port down Ultima to the console would probably be the best description of what they were trying to do.
There was a port of Ultima 4 for the NES. I don't know if it was released for the Famicom, but there was an NES port. But Dragon Quest, first you have Dragon Quest in 1986, and then you have Final Fantasy in 1987, which... Final Fantasy is the one that become the world beater. Dragon Quest still stops business in Japan whenever a new one comes out.
I would say Final Fantasy is the one that would eventually break back to the U.S. Dragon Quest has so much more cultural penetration in Japan. It's where you get slimes. It's where you get a certain design. I have 2 Ava figures that are done in Dragon Quest armor, for gosh sakes.
Oh, yeah.
It's a known style. But that was the thing. Pencil and paper RPG existed in Japan, but it really... American computer stuff lagged the progress of the pencil and paper stuff. I think the computer stuff drove the pencil and paper stuff in Japan.
I think some of that also is part of what helped pencil and paper stay dominant in the U.S. is that Japan never really suffered the video game crash like the U.S. did.
That's also true. It might also be, I don't know, because the other thing is maybe the Japanese just had more fun things to do at college than the Americans did.
It's possible.
The true deep, as opposed to the teenagers, you know, crouching around the Dungeon Master Shield, the truly deep adventures are mostly done in college.
Mm-hmm.
That is where the really pushy stuff goes. So anyway, you have a history where it's become very mainstream, although it's a borrowed mainstream for Japan.
Yes, it is.
So, even to the extent... I mean, well, D&D especially, it just sucks in from so many different sources.
Oh, absolutely. Because it takes from Tolkien, it takes from Arthurian legend, it takes from...
Voyage of the Space Beagle.
Yeah.
As we mentioned in the Dirty Pair episode.
Yeah.
Displacer Beasts. Hey. Other thing that D&D borrowed from that is worth mentioning, D&D actually borrowed from Japanese folklore.
Really?
And if you played Warcraft, you would have run into one of the leftover bits of that.
Well, I played Warcraft 3, so what bit am I
talking
about?
Remember the Ogre
Magi?
They're like an upgrade of ogres?
Oh. They weren't a unit in Warcraft 3, but I think they might have showed up in... Yeah, they weren't in Warcraft 3, but they might have showed up in... Wow, I'm not sure. It's been 10 years.
But the Ogre Magi, you have to understand something. Ogre Magi are essentially Oni.
Oh!
In fact, I think in the newer versions of D&D, they switched the name and just call them Oni and let it go at that.
In Warcraft 3, the Ogre are just Oni. Like, in terms of their design. They're just Oni. They've got the horns and everything.
Yeah. Well, in original D&D, there were ogres and Ogre Magi, which were 2 different groups of ogres. And the Ogre Magi were essentially what happens when the Tales of the Oni kind of drift through about 16 layers till they get to the U.S. because nobody had the internet back then.
Yeah.
But they're essentially the Oni, is what you're seeing there. And you see a lot of little bits and pieces of folklore drifted into D&D in weird ways like that. So that wasn't totally uncommon. Now, the interesting thing is the big push, TSR didn't really start making real bank on D&D until the late 80s.
When they made the TSR Gold Box RPGs?
TSR Gold Box RPGs. It was when their computer versions, like Hillsfar and all those, started coming out.
Yep.
When they got into the computer business, they started to really cash in a big way. And they had the movie, they had their cartoon series a little bit before that.
Mm-hmm.
But they were making some serious money. But the interesting thing, and because I will say I ran into this, got to Anime Con 1, and we're looking on TV, and there's a show called Record of Lodoss War. And Record of Lodoss War is D&D the anime. It plays all the tropes of D&D so straight.
It's incredibly straightforward.
Well, it's apparently adapted from somebody's campaign, from what I've heard, which totally believe.
Yeah, that would not surprise me in the least.
They said they were playing basically a D&D variant, which means they had a bunch of home rules. Who mm-hmm. doesn't?
Oh, yeah.
But they were essentially playing D&D, and they wrote down their campaign, and then they turned it into a book, and I think then it became an anime. And I'm looking at this anime, and I'm like, TSR, you have all the flipping money in the world. Why the heck haven't you licensed this? You would make so much money.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit of background on Record of Lodoss War, as Drew was saying, so we've been babbling on for 17, 18 minutes now about JRPGs. Record of Lodoss War comes around as a novel series in 1988, which puts it 1 year after Final Fantasy comes out, 2 years after Dragon Quest, and 3 years after Ultima 4. And it is written by Ryo Mizuno, and it was a Kadokawa. Thank you. It was published in English. Seven Seas Entertainment picked it up, by the way.
Ah, but right, that was a long time afterwards.
Yeah, because it was only founded in 2004. So it took 18 years for it to...
Yes.
Or so.
Now, the interesting thing about that is because... There are a bit. You'll see a fair number of fantasy OVAs, kind of mixed in and during the OVA boom of all types and descriptions. There's Heroic Legend of Aslan, which is
Arslan.
Pretty famous one. The interesting thing about Lodoss War, it is so straight D&D.
There's hardly any
deviation, which is unusual because. One of the things that you can tell about a Japanese adapted role-playing, Japanese interpretation of Western fantasy, is certain character types and certain stories are very to the forefront and certain ones are not.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Michael Moorcock Elric series is probably much more popular relatively and much more closer to the zeitgeist of fantasy and a lot of the more serious fantasies than it is in the U.S. However, you don't have any male lovely angel teams. You don't have Falvald and the Grey Mauser. You don't have poverty level heroic fantasy, or Thud and Blunder, as they referred to it back in the day. And you don't have a lot of Conan stories. Or, super strong, super loner type characters, even though the Conan movies made a fair amount of bank in Japan. Because those stories hadn't really ever made it to Japan.
Going back to our Shonen Jump discussion a little bit, it feels like the only time that you really got that was... the closest you get to that probably is actually Fist of the North Star, but that's post-apocalyptic.
That's post-apocalyptic. Well, the interesting thing is Berserk actually is.
It's
very
yeah,
much.
Berserk's probably the closest.
Berserk is kind of like Dark Souls. Because people always joke that Dark Souls is a Western RPG that happens to be made in Japan.
It's no soul made an RPG at Berserk. It's what it is. It's bleak and hard.
Yes, but in game design terms, it's designed like a Western RPG, even though it was made by the Japanese. Well, Berserk is essentially a Japanese is essentially what if Conan worked for Elric while he was a thief?
Yeah,
is the essential.
I can see that.
The whole Band of the Hawk is like, what if Conan had worked for Elric? If you want to take it all the way down to your archetypes. And again, because Conan doesn't show up that much in Japanese reference stuff.
No, he really doesn't.
It's because at that point, the Japanese weren't importing a whole lot of Western pop and pulp culture, because that was the late 20s, early 30s, and the government that was running things didn't approve of that kind of stuff. They did apparently get enough detective stories that the Japanese do a few private eye stories here and there, but not nearly as many.
Yeah.
But now, I digress. The point being, you have this strange sort of history, and what you get out, because Dragon Quest is goofy. But
it is.
It's very much on a, you know, level grinder. It's almost Munchkin the anime. You know, kill the monsters, take their stuff.
Yeah. Final Fantasy 1 is kind of like that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it has a story, but
just got more dramatic as it got older. But they're both, you know, they're dungeon crawlers. Very much so. In the very D&D mold.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate. It's here's a quest. It's going to lead to some kind of dungeon. Clear the dungeon. Move on to the next quest.
Exactly.
When you break it down to, like, bare basics, that's what it is.
You break down to bare basics. And then you have, you know, Record of Lodoss Wars, which is, it plays it so straight. I mean, your dwarf is a dwarf's dwarf.
Well, yeah, let's just go ahead and go down the character list for Lodoss War. So, starting off with our main character, Parn. He's a young swordsman, son of a knight, disgraced knight, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he's technically supposed to be a paladin, but they don't quite play that up very well.
Yeah, but I mean, just going over the party makeup. This is like D&D 101. Mm-hmm. You have a swordsman, which is probably is going to be that's your offensive warrior.
Yep.
You've got your elf, which is
Jack of all trades, master of none.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, she's a magic sword user. Ranged weapons,
magic, light fighting. Da 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 da.
You've got the priest, and then you've got the sorcerer, and then
you got the med user for damage and the medic to get you back to one piece, to duct tape you back together.
You have the dwarven warrior who, because it's not a game, we can't see their stats, but the fact that he's a dwarf. And that he's
a tank.
He's the tank, yeah. He's the one there basically to block attacks and get, be the strong one. And then you've got the thief. The thief.
Keep going.
That's the party. That's all
that's
eight
the,
of them.
That's the core party. Woodchuck.
No, Woodchuck's the thief.
He gets killed. Gets killed fairly early on.
Yeah.
And then eventually they run into the. And there's another recurring thing that seems to this particular character set. I don't know what the Japanese have about it, but the you have usually a secondary magician character, and they'll have a boyfriend / lover / bodyguard who's a berserker fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And Lodoss Wars has it. Slayers is almost built around it to some degree.
Which we'll get to. That's the other half of this discussion.
Yeah, and Slayers has it, and Ruin Explorers has it, essentially.
Which we will get to in our next episode.
So I'm like, what? Where is the basis of this character? Because I can't think of a particular you know, I can't think of a fantasy precursor for this character. It's just something the Japanese seem to have taken to.
This might be what it is. There is one character in Lodoss War that I absolutely want to discuss. And in terms of the whole of Record of Lodoss War, in addition to it, you know, being kind of the serious fantasy show, there's something else incredibly major about its influence. And that's Deedlit. So if you're listening along at home, go to Google. Google anime elf. I swear to God, every single anime elf that has been done since 1991 is a descendant of Deedlit.
And again, this is one spot where you can tell that D&D was not the only influence.
Mm-hmm.
Because D&D elf have Spock ears at best.
Yeah.
They do not have terribly large ears. They don't even have peony ears. But Deedlit has these great big honking leaf ears that are like as tall as her head. And most anime elves ever since, in fact, 99% of them, have these gargantuan ears. And I remember there is not a lot of pictures of elves in tunnels and trolls. But I will say this. They much more tended towards that design than the D&D elves. D&D elves, like I said, Spock ears.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's other, so some of the characters that I can talk about that obviously have her influence is, for example, even though it's in an RPG, probably one of the most well-known to modern viewers would be Leafa from Sword Art Online. I know that's technically a fairy, but she's got the elf ears, she's got the green clothes, the reasonably tall figure. Another one is one of the characters, the elf character from How Not to Summon a Demon Lord. There's an elf character that shares that design in Goblin Slayer. One of our favorite shows, Gate. One of the main characters is basically just a modern version of Deedlit.
She pretty much is like, does Deedlit know you're... Somebody should have her wear a Deedlit t-shirt at some point.
Like, I should just make a Deedlit family tree.
Yeah. No, well, elves are essentially immortal. It could just be that this girl's gained a lot of work.
Little known fact, anime is not drawn, it is actually cast. And they just have one elf actress that's been working in every single show.
Yeah, they only have one elf, so they have to work her. She has to work by her elf.
But no, I'm serious. Like, go and Google anime elf, and they are all blue-eyed, or pretty much mostly blue-eyed blondes, reasonably tall, with the really long elf ears. I mean, I think even the manga, plus-sized elf, has that same character design.
It is strange because, you know, their dwarf is different. I mean, their dwarf, other than the fact that he pretty much stole Gimli's name. Jeez Louise. I mean, they weren't even trying when they... Yim! Or Kim! Gosh, that's not even trying, folks. But, again, Lodoss War is...
Well, yeah, because really they give him...
But it's very by the numbers.
It is. It is a very paint-by-numbers kind of thing.
Extremely paint-by-numbers. The fact of it is...
It's prolific.
Stunning how it's incredibly paint-by-numbers, especially because it wasn't licensed by TSR. They didn't have those guys hanging over them the whole time, making them do this. They just... It was osmosis.
They just did it.
They just did it.
Well, what's crazy about Lodoss War is it's one of those series... well, one of the things I want to point out, it is an early Madhouse for the OVA. But just how prolific this series is, to give you an idea, is you had the 7+2 side stories for the novels. And then we got... I'm not even going to name them off, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6... 8... game releases, the most recent of which is 2020. The first one being in 1988. You have the 13-episode OVA from 90 to 91. You have manga in 91 to 2001, which is weird because it's only two volumes. Another novel series from 94 to 2002. Another manga from 93 to 94. Another manga from 94 to 98. Another manga. Another manga. Another manga. I swear I didn't just break the audio.
When did aspiring fantasy mangaka grow up drawing these characters?
Mm-hmm. And then we also had the anime TV series, which I've never seen. I've not seen the TV series. I've only seen the OVA. And for me, like this is an episode that this I was the one. I'm going to be honest with you, folks. I was the one that was pushing for this one because this was kind of my intro to animation. Well, not animation, but anime. Outside of the Toonami block, I remember going to my library and I picked up two tapes. This was one of them. The other one was Slayers, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. But I picked up this one, and at the time,
so you were a D&D nerd at the time, weren't you, Rick?
I was not a D&D nerd yet, actually. Albeit I was, but I didn't know I was yet.
Okay,
when I picked these up, when I picked these up, it was when I was big on Baldur's Gate 2 for the PC.
One of the games that TSR was using to...
Yes.
The TSR used to make all that money that they should have used to license Lodoss Wars.
Yes, again, Baldur's Gate 2, like Throne of Ball. But yeah, no, I mean, we've gotten... Like, Lodoss War is one of those series that's never gone away. It's constantly putting out new stuff. I mean, there's a novel series going on right now that is current. And it's the same author, Ryo Mizuno. It's a solid series. I'm not going to go into too much detail because there's a lot to go over.
And a lot of plot, not a lot of original characters.
Yes, it's very, like, to be honest, a lot of these probably could have been pulled from D&D modules. I wouldn't be surprised, like when I was reading over some of it and watching some of it, I'm like, I'm surprised Gygax doesn't have a co-author credit for some of this.
Like I said, this was so tightly adapted to D&D standards, aside from D-Lit being a big fan-eared elf and not a Spock elf.
Yeah, but everything else about her is basically spot on. And probably the reason why they gave her the really long ears is because the dwarf has regular elf ears.
Yeah. That's also possible, yeah, because
they wanted to make her, you know, a little
differentiate.
Different. Yeah.
But, and also, like I said, they had some different sources.
Yeah, that's
but,
also
yeah,
true.
Lodoss Wars is one of those times when you sit here, when you spot something in Japanese pop culture and you're like, holy cow, I didn't realize that had gotten through that completely. That when
it's very unfiltered.
Yeah, very unfiltered. It's like, whoa, that is, you know, that would pass muster at TSR.
Yeah, you can kind of look at it and go be like, Wizards of the Coast may want to be may want to get their lawyers ready.
Before Wizards of the Coast, if TSR had got Lodoss Wars, they would have had the money that Wizards of the Coast wouldn't be able to buy them.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah, could you imagine that world if Wizards of the Coast didn't have D&D?
It'll be interesting because
it'd be very interesting.
But. Yeah, and they don't go too deep into the Tolkien-esque things. They don't usually have to worry too much about their...
Yeah, that's true.
They don't have to worry about the TSR legal department jokes, of which there are many. Phil Folio has done dozens of them. Many other people have, too.
Phil Folio, neat guy.
Neat guy. Cool guy, yes. Have you seen my new engagement circular metal band? Are you guys still having trouble with the Tolkien estate? The phone is circular metal banding.
Oh, my God.
That is from one of his. That's from What's New. The last What's New in the original Dragon Run, when they wanted to do sex in D&D and they went wandering through the TSR offices. That was the legal department.
So from from Lodoss War, we move on to one of my favorite series of all time. So much so that I have the English voice actress's signature of the main series of the main character on the box set of the series. And for me, that's Slayers. And Drew, disagree with me. Feel free to disagree with me. But I feel like Slayers might be one of the most single influential shows when it comes to fantasy anime. When you look at things such as design aesthetic and character archetypes, you know, plot lines, that kind of thing.
Slayers is like the Dragon Ball of Japanese high fantasy.
Yeah.
It's the silly action show that set the pattern that everybody has stolen ever since.
Yes, and we do mean stolen.
It shares some of the same shticks as Dragon Ball in some cases.
Yeah.
The massive meals, for one thing. And I would also say this, and I've said this before about... Remember I talk about your first anime series?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Slayers is your first anime series, but he's also a lot of other people's first anime series.
It is.
You are not allowed to talk smack on pain of death, because this is the series that got me into it.
I'm not that bad about it, because I realize that it's not for everyone, but I've also kind of come to the realization that that's the case with anyone's first series. Just because it's your first series and you may think it's the best thing in the world doesn't mean that other people are going to, you know, find it the same way. Possibly because their first series was something polar opposite. But one of the big things about Slayers is that this series has been going on forever. I mean,
it never seems to quite die.
Yeah, like it started off as a light novel in 1989 with 17 volumes. That was the original, and it's still running, actually. Then there was Slayers Special, which ran from 91 to 2008. That was 30 volumes. It had a manga, a one-off manga, that was in 95. There's another one, 95, from 95 to 2008. And really, I would say the thing that I first started off with is the original Slayers TV series, which has been, you know, Slayers. And then that one, it's actually by a studio that I don't think is around anymore. It was done by E&G Studios.
I don't think they're around.
Yeah, I don't think they are. I don't think they are, because the most recent series they did, which was 2008 and 2009, that was done by JC Staff. Which, if you don't know who JC Staff is, they're best known for Shogeki no Soma, Food Wars, Index, Toradora. Familiar of Zero, Utena. They did Utena as well. So that's, you know, that was kind of their main, you know, their big ones. Just a couple of them. But so Slayer, like Slayers is one of those things that has its DNA basically all over the modern, you know, all over the modern landscape of anime.
The other thing you have to bring up though about Slayers in general,
mm-hmm.
is that it also came out at just the right time with just the right star. Because this is a Megumi Hashibara joint.
Mm-hmm.
First to last. Although, obviously, you like the American actor, too. But she took on Lena Inverse at the same time she was doing Ranma-chan. This is she was the all-conquering, spunky heroine of the universe. And that had a lot to do with what really pushed Slayers and Ranma 1/2 are the two biggest series that put her over the top. Although she was in a ton of other ones.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that I have the in terms of English voice actors, I have the TV series English voice actor Lisa Ortiz. I don't have Cynthia Martinez, who did the OVAs and films. So, thing to note about Slayers is there's kind of I'm not sure if that's the case or not. This is a big Slayers fan. I think it's the same continuity, and I think the OVAs and films, like, this is the way I look at it. The OVAs and films are the early adventures of Lena Inverse alongside Naga the Serpent.
Why they called her a serpent? Because the only serpent I've ever seen with Bazonga dogs that size was in was the last time I was playing XCOM 2.
I don't. I'm not 100% sure. I'm actually not 100% sure. Because I did not watch the OVAs in movies as recently, so I'd have to refresh my memory. There is something important about her, though, that she actually is the sister of one of the main characters of the TV series.
Yeah.
But what's kind of crazy about this one is that it's got the Pokemon cast all over it. Mm. The English dub. So one of our other main characters, Gowrie, as he's pronounced, at least in the English version, is played by Eric Stewart, who's best known for the voice of James and Brock in Pokemon. let's see here. Amelia has one voice actress for three episodes. And then for the next 90, she's voiced by Veronica Taylor. Veronica Taylor is best known as the original voice of Ash Ketchum from Pokemon. So it's one of those, you know, like I said, my exposure to anime up to that point had been like the Toonami blocks and then also a little bit the Kids WB. So I was watching Pokemon and Digimon. So I pick up this fantasy, you know, these two fantasy tapes from the library. I start watching this one and I go, wait a minute, that's Brock. Wait a minute, that's Ash. That was the first time I realized, oh, they often have time actresses do young male characters. That's really when I became cognizant of that idea, of that fact. So that was kind of an important thing for me as well. But I've watched Slayers in both English and in Japanese, and the casts are really good. Megumi is great as Lena, and Lisa's also really good. I do like Cynthia in the OVAs, but it is definitely Lisa and Cynthia's portrayal are definitely slightly different. But I feel that works because Slayers of the OVA and Slayers of the TV series, they're very similar, but they're not the same. Because you've got different... you've got kind of different dynamics. Because in the
Slayers,
TV series...
Slayers of the OVA is the odd couple slash
yes.
Lovely Angels magician couple. Walk
very
in,
much.
Blow shit up, cause trouble, and then disappear.
Yeah.
Whereas the TV series tends to have arcs.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
The TV series is about a party, because you have Lena Inverse, who is a powerful sorceress who is probably a little too powerful for her own good, who lacks a certain amount of subtlety, and is always being called short and flat.
Because
and then
she's 14.
She starts
in the OVA
collecting companions. So she collects Gory.
First she goes traveling with Naga.
Yeah.
So the OVAs and
the
films.
OVAs. Yes.
Yeah. She travels with Naga first. That's the films and the OVAs. And so you have this like you said, the odd couple dynamic, because you have short, you know, 14-year-old Lena Inverse, red hair. Temper to match.
Red hair, temper to match, clothed head to foot, completely covered over.
Yeah. And then you have
looks
Naga.
Looks like a young boy in a lot of from certain angles.
Yeah.
And is resentful about it sometimes. And then you have Naga, who's, what, 5'10"?
Naga, who's built like a pinup.
Yes.
Is the best way I can describe it. And is a Himadari, by the way.
Yes, and she has the...
both in personality and in actuality, because she is a runaway princess.
and is even more out of control than Lena is on the magical front.
Yeah.
If not quite as competent.
Which by the way, that outfit she's wearing, if you're listening to this, Google Naga the Serpent. In her background, the outfit she's wearing, she found in her mother's closet after her mother's funeral. So, take that how you will.
Then
it's the TV series that you start picking up the cast of goofballs is the way I kind of describe it. So you have like a main four in the cast in the TV series. You have Lena. Then of course you have Gowrie, as you're going to say, who is kind of the dumbass swordsman.
He's as like, loyal as man's best friend, but not as smart.
Yes. That's actually, that's not Drew's own words, by the way. That is
somebody
from his manga profile.
Then
you have the cool guy, who is Zelgadis, and he is a chimera. He was a man that was turned into basically a rock golem. Now, of course, this is being anime. He is a very pretty boy, but he is still made into rock.
Yes. He's, you know, he's the, not really edgy, but depressed pretty boy.
He's played by Crispin Freeman for most of the series in English. If that gives you an idea.
He's the angsty boy.
Yeah, he's the angsty boy. He's the Lancer, basically.
Yeah.
And then you have the Genki Deary, which is Amelia, who, by the way, is Naga's younger sister.
We eventually find out.
Well, it's never straight up said in the TV series, but it's heavily implied. It's kind of, you have to put two and two together and have watched the entire series to figure that out. And I only kind of knew that because I've seen all of it.
I've heard that that's pretty well known as pretty well known fan knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and she's, you know, is the defender of justice and the one that's going to get them killed if they're not close, if they're not careful. And then they go on various adventures. I think there's chasing the Red Priest, and then there's another adventure. But mostly they go out to go into dungeons, beat up monsters, and take their stuff.
Yeah.
And occasionally they beat up bandits and take their stuff.
Well, and there's all kinds of, like, in the major characters, there's all kinds of crazy characters that come by. You have Zelos, who is a priest. He's also a monster. Mm-hmm. And you're never quite sure what he's going to do. You don't know if he's going to help this week, or if you don't know if he's going to screw them this week. One of my other favorite characters, by the way, is Philia, which is from Slayer's Try. That's the third series. Mm-hmm. She's a golden dragon.
Aha!
And she uses a big-ass mace that she keeps in her garter. And she's able to switch between dragon and human form. So she's kind of fun, but apparently she had to get Lena because she couldn't find Lena's older sister, Luna.
Everybody has an older brother or an older sister in this series, it seems.
Now, my favorite, I just recently watched Revolution and Revolutionary R. There was also a light novel which actually combined this along with another series that I liked from that era, which was Sorcerer Stabber Orphan.
Mm-hmm.
That was a light novel that came out in 2005. It was Revolution and then Evolution R were the two most recent TV series, and they're sort of like one of those ones where even though they're like two different TV series technically, they just play directly into each other. It's like the plot of one mm-hmm. continues into the next one. In the first season of that, the Revolution, the plot is basically that Lena is constantly being harassed with the threat of arrest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the plot to that one.
Yeah, she's.
And it's not actually for anything she actually did. That's the thing.
Oh.
Yeah, it's one of those.
I mean, she's enough trouble for the crime she did commit.
And then, in the second part, that kind of gets dropped a little bit, because now they ran into a sentient suit of armor that is heavily implied to be Naga. Who, by the way, is an amnesiac. So it's an amnesiac suit of armor. Who happens to be Naga.
Who happens to be Naga.
But doesn't remember her name's Naga, so they call her Nama.
What would happen if Nama met Alphonse?
They would have a bunch of tin cans.
No, she'd detonate his puberty first. But, yeah.
I absolutely love Slayers, but the reason I want to talk about it is not just because I love Slayers, and I highly recommend viewing it. It's because, really, there's a lot of shows out there now that we wouldn't have if it wasn't for Slayers. Like, I'll be honest, I don't think Konosuba would be a thing if we didn't have Slayers to come first.
Slayers is definitely the original comedy fantasy that everybody is copying. Mm-hmm. It may not have been the first, I don't think it was, but it's definitely the one that everybody copied.
It's the template, basically.
Yeah, it's the template. Again, we still haven't figured out what it is with magic users and their dumb berserker boyfriends, but they got that one too.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I like to point out is that this is a show that gets referenced a lot. Mm-hmm. I was watching some show relatively recently. I don't remember which one it was. And Lena Inverse just had like a cameo out of nowhere. Like just showed up.
Well, like, remember what happened in
the show or something.
Remember what happened in Amagi Brilliant Park.
That was what I was going to get to next, is where Moffle starts to actually do the Dragon Slave.
Yes. The infamous Dragon Slave, which is more or less the fantasy nuke spell.
Yeah. It's also actually, going back to Konosuba, the Dragon Slave makes Megumin's explosion look like child's play.
But Megumin's joke is essentially that she's Lena Inverse who can only throw the Dragon Slave.
Slave, and that's it.
And once. That's it. Once per day.
I mean, actually, if you look at Megumin, she even kind of dresses like Lena.
Yeah.
In terms of the overall... But although that kind of look is actually kind of pretty common in more modern... Like, especially the Isekai series. Yeah. Isekai, that style of outfit. Yeah. Like...
Yeah. But, again, there's definitely a certain amount of... You know... Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Most certainly. Most certainly.
They all are just stealing from one for the other. But, yeah, so we're talking, what, 5 or 6 TV series? A half a dozen OVAs and movies?
Yeah.
To get through it all? And not... The TV series have some continuity.
They actually have pretty good continuity from one TV series to the next. They tend not to step on each other too much. The OVA is where it gets a little bit more questionable. Like... I have to rewatch the OVAs and the movies, but it almost feels like if there's not 100% back and forth continuity, there's probably a one way continuity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where it's like the shit that happens in this is, the shit that happened in the other things is canon in this, but what happens in this isn't canon in that. You know, like one of those kind of situations. It's not a two-way street with the canon. But I think I'm trying to... The problem is the Wikipedia page is also kind of a mess with the release dates. Because it actually doesn't list the films or the OVAs. It does. So we have 4 films and 2 OVAs. We have Slayers Perfect, Slayers Return, Slayer's Great and Slayer's Gorgeous. That's the films. Those are 95, 96, 97, and 98. Slayer's The Book of Spells is 96. That's an OVA. Slayer's Excellent is 98. That's also an OVA. And then they had Slayer's Premium in 2001, which is a short film. For the TV series, we had the original Slayers, which was 95 to 95. It was April to September. April to September of 96 for Slayers Next. Slayers Try, April to September of 97. And then we didn't get another Slayers for 10 years. Over 10 years, 11 years, actually. And that was Slayers Revolution. That was July to September of 2008. Followed by January to April of 2009 for Slayers Evolution R. So that's what? That's seven films and OVAs plus five TV series?
That's so a lot of material.
There's 12 different things that you can go out and find. I have most of it on my shelf in the living room. Friend of mine is like, yeah, I just got these and I'm not a big fan of Slayers. You want them? I'm like, yes.
Please.
Give me. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say both of these shows are pretty important when it comes to sort of setting the mold for fantasy. This is definitely for, like you said, for the comedy. Like, things like Konosuba, and I'd say maybe a little bit of ReZero, and even some of the more serious ones. Like, I can see some Slayers influence in Slayers, and even Lodos in a little bit more serious shows, like Rising of Shield Hero. I'm trying to think of a couple other ones that are recent. Weirdly, did not see a ton of it in the most recent show I watched, which was this is something I've kind of wanted to talk about for a little while, is that these shows are also kind of a relic of an era that you don't see anymore. And I think that Gigak has talked about on this in his channel. I'm not sure if some of the other ones. I don't think Mother's Basement's talked about it yet. And that is sort of the death of the traditional fantasy anime.
Well, with the isekai have kind of moved in and squashed them flat.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to do a fantasy, I mean, they've sort of picked up the ball where the fantasy anime were, you know, dropped it, for lack of a better term. And they've picked up a lot of those tropes. Because, no, like, almost every single modern show that I picked, that I told you about, that I've seen these, you know, some of these elements in, is an isekai.
It's true.
I mean, one of our favorite shows is a reverse isekai. No, actually, no, it is an isekai. It's not a reverse isekai. It's just straight up an isekai. Which is Gate. Oh,
Gate's kind of a...
But you still see some of those elements.
Yeah, you still do. It's like everybody knows about the fantasy. Everybody knows the fantasy tropes now. I'm still waiting for them to do a serious... Well, there have been a couple of serious isekais, but I'm looking for something along the level of, say, Guardians of the Flame or 1632 or something with some meat on it that to really get into the isekai genre. Because very thin.
I think a lot of that simply becomes is that the driving force behind isekai is the light novel scene. And light novels aren't exactly known for their super heavy content.
No.
They can be drama, but not like, they don't really go for the super dark. At least as far as I've seen.
Not just the dark, but the putting some depth into the story.
Yeah, but I mean, light novels are meant to be kind of, well, light.
Well, yeah, I know, but
the two shows we're talking about are a good example. Slayer started as a light novel series. It might be one of the first light novel ones that we've looked at in terms of age. I can't think of too many that were covered that were light novels specifically originally.
Technically light novels.
Which ones?
Dirty Parent Crusher Joe are all.
Yeah. Okay. I thought those were novels. Like novels.
They didn't make as much of a distinction in the split.
Okay. It might be because these ones are from a little bit later, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, but like it's become more ghettoized or split off.
Mm-hmm. Because Slayers is specifically listed as a light novel, and then Lodoss is specifically listed as a novel. But, you know,
also, I think the classic light novels of this day are like, they're also limited in length. They're very much novella length.
Well, also, Slayers was actually published in a magazine. Whereas, like Lodoss War was like, you went and bought the Lodoss War book.
Yeah.
It was not like, you know, something you read in a publication.
Lodoss War is a fantasy novel.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I'm waiting for the Japanese to do their version of the couple of the, not super heavy duty, but I mean, there's been at least 3 or 4 Dream Park stories,
mm-hmm.
in full length novels. There's been the aforementioned Guardians of the Flame series. That was about 7 novels. And those are both, well, one is Dream Park is like fantasy Disneyland,
yeah.
sort of. And Guardians of the Flame is isekai. It is isekai before isekai was isekai.
Well, yeah.
And no one is.
I mean, if you think about it, the Chronicles of Narnia are isekai.
Chronicles of Narnia isekai. So is Connecticut.
It's isekai King with Arthur. A Jesus lion.
Yeah, they're very. The point is, though, Guardians of the Flame is very much on the basic isekai set, but it's in a pencil and paper universe, not a computer universe. So,
yeah,
but it also has a lot better world building than a lot of the contemporary isekai novels. But that's so, neither here nor there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like Slayers is. It's a big thing from way back when. It's really important if you want to know why Megumi Hashibara was so big. That and Ranma-chan are her two. I mean, she was in a ton of stuff. She was every spunky heroine for like 3 years. And then she eventually did her career. She did her career change around 95. Because she did the heroine in Blue Seed, who's your basic spunky heroine. Mm-hmm. Then she immediately did Rei Ayanami. And when she came out the other side of being Rei Ayanami, she suddenly started playing characters like Faye Valentine.
Yeah, the more mature characters.
Yeah. She started playing World... She also got married about that time, which might have had something to do with it.
Probably a little bit.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit.
She started playing world-weary women of action.
Yeah.
So she transitioned through Rei to an entirely different type of role. But back in those days, she would have been Congo if she could do the English.
Yeah, she would have been. I can totally see that.
She would have been.
So luckily for us, both of these series, Lodoss War and Slayers, shouldn't be too hard to find. They're both been picked up by Funimation from the ADV mess.
Lodoss Wars was originally
U.S.
Manga Corps.
Oh, it was U.S. Manga Corps? Okay. But,
yeah, it was U.S. Manga Corps.
Yeah, but it did get picked up by Funimation eventually.
Slayers was like Genom. ADV had the OVAs and the movies, and mm-hmm. Genom had the TV series.
Yeah.
That was also why you had 2 different casts.
But they've both been picked up by Funimation at this point, so I don't know if they've done a reprint or not yet, but they have it. I've seen Slayers pop up on... I think Slayers was on Hulu recently, to be honest. I've seen it on streaming services recently. And I'm not talking about, like, the sketchy ones. I mean, like, ones that you pay for. not like Kiss Anime, rest in peace. That died, by the way. I recommend if you ever get a chance, like you're in a used video store and you see a copy of one of these, I absolutely recommend picking up, especially Slayers. You know, if you see it on
Lodoss Wars, it's good for getting your D&D troll out of his basement mm-hmm. and watching anime with you.
Yeah. I'll say this. the saying I've always said about these two shows, I told you this, Drew, before we started recording, is Lodoss is what your party thinks they look like while playing D&D. Slayers is probably what they actually look like.
Very true.
So, well, for next week's episode, we are going to be continuing our discussion of fantasy, going from the giants of the early 90s anime scene to something a little bit smaller. Next week, we take a look at Ruin Explorers and Dragon Half. So until next time, I've been Rick.
I've been Drew.
And just remember, someone had to draw
had
that.
To draw that.
In my thoughts and in my dreams, they're always in my mind. These songs of hobbits, dwarves, and men, and elves.